This is the Thrive Content Clubcast.
Hello and welcome to the Content Clubcast. I'm Bronte, a learning designer here at Thrive. And this podcast series is all about imposter syndrome, where I'll be joined by various guests to talk about their views and experiences of it. In today's episode, my guest is Diane Everett, a clinical psychologist who is here to share her thoughts on the topic. Hello, Diane.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No worries. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Would you like to start by introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a clinical psychologist. I have been working in mental health since around 2010, did some time on the NHS and then left to go full-time into private practice in 2017. So I've been working in private practice and have kind of found my way in a specialism, working very specifically with high achievers who struggle with high functioning anxiety. And imposter syndrome is one of the very prominent ways that that tends to manifest in high functioning anxiety. So something I'm really passionate about and really excited to be talking about today.
Yeah, I think I read a statistic somewhere that 70% of people in their lifetime will struggle with imposter syndrome. So yeah, it's quite big, isn't it?
Absolutely. That is very correct. And yeah, I think it's something that so many people relate to, myself included. I can remember coming into private practice and feeling really strange about the fact that people were now paying me to deliver a service that had otherwise been free for them on the NHS. And I think it's something I've also experienced very personally myself. So even more so, something I'm passionate about.
Not sure if you know, but within the NHS, is there a lot of help for things like imposter syndrome?
It's an interesting question. So typically, the NHS tends to focus on more. So imposter syndrome is not an official diagnosis, and the NHS has very lovely services that focus specifically on very nuanced processes around anxiety. So they typically wouldn't have something that would treat the high achievers because there are just a whole host of people who have more desperate and more pressing issues. The high achievers who tend to really struggle with imposter syndrome also are the types of people who compensate really well, and on the surface they look like they have everything all together, and so not the typical type of person that you would generally find on an NHS service.
Yeah, that was pretty much going to be my next question as well. So I guess, how would you describe in your own words what imposter syndrome is, or what you perceive it to be? Because I know there's a lot of different ideas on what it is and what it isn't as well.
Yeah, so we could get into the nuances, but generally speaking, it is defined as a feeling of being a fraud. A lot of people will talk about feeling like I'm not quite qualified to do the job that I'm being asked to do. And that very often comes with an underlying mechanism. There's a lot of self-doubt, a lot of perfectionism at play, really intense fear of failure, discounting any source of success that is achieved, a strong comparison to other people. And then very typically what we see in imposter syndrome is this mechanism of overachieving. So people will overperform, overwork themselves, and internally, what we see is a narrative of very negative and critical self-talk, where there's this kind of monologue in your mind on a daily basis, constantly criticizing and never quite feeling like you're enough.
Yeah. And is it always high achievers?
So it's not necessarily always high achievers. I think high achievers are very prone to it because they tend to hold themselves to a really high standard. A high achiever really is just somebody who has generally really good insight and self-awareness, holds himself to a really high standard, and really pushes the boundaries in terms of wanting to fulfill their absolute potential. And so we see this striving for performance to really match what people know that they're capable of. So that category of people is incredibly prone to imposter syndrome, but there are also other categories that do experience it. A lot of people who are in very competitive work environments, I think that's another field in which it will manifest. And then what we also rarely see it crop up is when people have had an experience in an environment that has been very critical, or the expectations have been really high and they don't quite feel like they've been able to meet the expectations or the demands, sometimes that can also be something that chips away at a person's sense of self. And imposter syndrome is very often something that will pop up as a byproduct of that.
Yeah, personally, I've definitely had it when I've been starting out in a new job. You know, I know I've worked hard to be there. I know there's been sometimes even like hundreds of applicants and I've made it through to that final stage and I've got the job. So I know I deserve it and I'm worthy of it. But I have just felt like an imposter, especially in the first couple of weeks. So yeah, I can understand why it'd be the environment as well. My next kind of question was, do you find it less common for men to open up about imposter syndrome? Because I think I read that early research was predominantly done on women. Is that correct? Do you know much about that?
Yeah, so I think generally speaking, and this is a very broad generalization, women tend to seek therapy more. They tend to seek help more. And so there are very naturally, obviously, some more conversations that we as psychologists tend to have around these things with women. But I think it's a stereotype. I think we obviously have the gender stereotypes where men are expected to hold the line and put on a brave face. Interestingly, the research has shown historically that the way that men and women respond to this type of thing tends to vary. So men tend to overwork and overachieve and compensate for their underlying feelings of inadequacy in that way, whereas women are a lot more likely to seek help. And I think that's largely got to do with the way that men and women relate. So women will, again, it's a stereotype and I don't love stereotypes, but sometimes it's useful for us to understand the kind of general theme. So women will tend to open up and have a meaningful conversation and share all of their stories and all of their secrets, whereas men are less likely to speak in that way. That said, I think we're definitely seeing a trend and a movement away from this being something that is a problem that women seek help for. And I think we're seeing more and more men starting to find the courage to put their hand up and say, I'm really struggling, I need help. And so we are definitely seeing an increase in the number of men who are seeking help with this type of thing. And when men do come into therapy, they tend to be as open as women in talking about it. And yeah, I'm hopeful that we're seeing quite a change in the trends there.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's definitely a topic that's become really popular. That's exactly why we're covering it, in Content Club as well, because a lot of people are talking about it. And as I said earlier, a lot of people have different views on it, which is why I wanted to do this podcast, just to talk to different people and hear their views as well. One question I did have is whether you think it can be a positive and a negative thing. And if it can be a positive thing, how so, I guess?
It's a really interesting question. So it depends on what the person is aiming for. So one of the things that we do know is that it can be an incredible driving force. So sometimes people will come to therapy to see me and they will say, I'm struggling with all of these symptoms. Then we'll talk about this high functioning anxiety with imposter syndrome kind of being at the center of that. And then I will actually say to them, there's kind of a warning or a disclaimer before you start this process. Sometimes what we see, very frequently what we see, is that as we take away the imposter syndrome and people become a little bit more comfortable in their skin and they feel less of a need to really be proving themselves and eliciting a sense of worth through their performance in the work environment, some of their motivation and their drive comes down and they find themselves being less invested than they otherwise would. And people at that stage tend to get really worried that their performance is going to drop, particularly in work. And so I think sometimes it's a really useful motivating structure that's in place that is, it accounts for a lot of the drive and the motivation that people have to perform. On the other hand, and I think this is always, we always have to consider what, if something's working for somebody, then it's working really well. And what we're really thinking about is, where does this become a problem? What's the point at which it goes from being something where you can really leverage your potential to something that is potentially quite destructive to you as a process? And one of the things that we see here is when you get onto the slippery slope of burnout, that's the point at which we're going, okay, it's time to wind it back and let's really unpack it and start to undo some of the mechanisms, even if it means you have to compromise and sacrifice on some of that overachieving drive that you have.
Yeah, because going back to that kind of example of when I, you know, started a new job and I felt like an imposter, I wonder if actually it wasn't imposter syndrome and I just, you know, just felt nervous, would I have as much drive and motivation to, you know, make as much of a good impression? So that was kind of the reason I asked that one. When people obviously come to you for therapy in terms of imposter syndrome, do they need to know, or do you try and figure out where it came from in order to then, I guess, work through it?
Certainly, that's always the starting point in any process that we're working through. The more thorough our understanding of what's going on and exactly where that comes from, the more we can figure out exactly what the nuance is in terms of treating it. So usually the starting point with this in therapy is figuring out how much of this is an external component, how much of this is an internal component. So an internal component would look like coming from a family where there was an incredibly critical narrative that people have then internalized, and all of us have an inner self monologue that we're constantly listening to on a daily basis. And so very often what we see is there is this critical voice that lives inside of us. Most people are quite oblivious to this. It's kind of in a chat that flows on a daily basis where we're always thinking. And very often that will be a very critical voice. So if it's more of an inner process, then we really work with that. We work from understanding where that's come from. And then we want to really shift that monologue into a dialogue where we teach people to start to play devil's advocate and to speak back to that voice by looking for evidence, by looking at the facts, by taking themselves out of the emotional response that can be really loud and compelling, telling them all sorts of things about how they have not achieved to the standard they would like to. And we're just going, okay, let's take a step back from the emotion and get logical about this. What do we see as evidence? What do we see as feedback? And we really teach people to integrate the feedback that they're getting. The positive is most people with imposter syndrome only integrate the negative feedback, and that's a cognitive bias that we all have. So that's the inner process. Sometimes it's more of an external process, like the one that you've described in your story. I love that. It's an incredibly common story that we see where people come from these work environments that have, for one or other reason, been quite destructive to their self-esteem. And that's more of an external process. So in situations like that, we're working slightly differently with it. Sometimes it's really nice to put somebody, best case scenarios, we'll put them into what I call a rehabilitative work context where there's a lot of support. It's a good cultural fit. And then we see it really kind of irons itself out. And then we're also working with developing an internal sounding board. So that's shifting away from being really worried about what everybody else thinks about your performance and shifting the question to, what do you think about your performance? And are you living your life and making decisions in a way that you are pleased with and you are satisfied with, as opposed to constantly feeling like you have to jump through all of these hoops to appease everybody around you?
With the inner voice that you mentioned, I've heard someone say that they've named their inner voice. Do you ever have people naming theirs and like talking back to a specific name?
It's interesting that you bring that up. That's actually one of the mechanisms that I will specifically work with people. It kind of depends. So we have some really creative brains who respond really well to that type of thing. And then we will develop this as an external persona. And it's really nice. I had somebody once name their voice Betty Lou, as this kind of like Southern American, and we used to joke about Betty Lou. What's Betty Lou been saying? Is she nagging at you again? And it's just a really lovely way to make a very internal unconscious process external. And it gives us so much to work with. It means it's a dialogue instantly. The moment you're talking to something, I also think what's useful, and one of the things I recommend, is to imagine, you know, those little cartoon characters that we see on Disney films where you have the angel and the devil sitting on Mickey Mouse's shoulder or something like that. Sometimes it's really useful to imagine that little voice. Who's speaking? Is it the angel? Is it the devil? Who are you feeding? Who are you listening to? We can have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm gonna name my inner critic for the next time I start a new job. No, that's really great. Thank you so much for talking to me. If people want to kind of get further professional help from you, where would be best for them to go?
Yeah, so if people want to contact me, the easiest way is to go through my website.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for being my guest here. It's been really great having you on and hearing your thoughts about imposter syndrome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely speaking to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Content Clubcast.
Join me next time for another episode of Talking About All Things Imposter Syndrome. See you then.
You've been listening to the Thrive Content Podcast. Visit www.thrivelearning.com for more information. Be bold. Be brave. Thrive.